call the regular and supplemental meetings are called to order. We will recess the supplemental meeting, and the first thing I'd like to have is a moment of silence for those that are not with us anymore. Thank you. First item would be the minutes from the January 11th meeting. Does anyone have any comments or questions on those? If not, we have a motion to approve those.
Motion
to
approve those.
Second?
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Now, would anyone like to make a public comment? Also, I want to say good morning. Didn't say that beforehand, so good morning to everybody.
Morning.
Glad to have you all here. Be a big year, 2024, for DTFP. Anybody like to make a public comment?
No.
John, anyone on?
No, but if I just call on their own, I need them for public comment.
Okay. Moving on, our 2022 financial audit, Jill and Matt from BDO. Jill?
Sure.
The mic is yours.
Awesome. Is there a yes?
There is a
quicker signature than that. Challenging what I said. Oh, okay. Okay, great. Wonderful. Okay, so we'll get started. We did just meet with the audit committee, so I will try not to bore you as much as I bored them with all of the information. We did complete our audit of the financial statements, and we issued our audit report on February 1st, so a week ago on the 2022 financial statements. I do want to just remind everyone that the objective of a financial statement audit is to obtain reasonable, not absolute assurance that the financial statements are free from material on the statements, and we did achieve that level of assurance. The scope of our work was substantially the same as that reported in our planning communication. As it relates to other information in the financial statements, we do read through all of the MD&A and the other discussion and make sure that it is consistent with the financial statements, and we do go through that. We did not have any issues there. I do want to thank management for their cooperation. Everything we needed was freely made available to us, and individuals were very responsive as we worked through our audit procedures. As it relates to accounting practices, policies, estimates, I would say those are disclosed in the financial statements in Note 2, and they were consistently applied throughout the year, and there hadn't been any changes from the prior year. So that's always good. We don't like to see accounting policies changing year to year, so everything was consistently applied. I will say the most significant estimate within the financial statements, which is no surprise, are the actuarial estimates and the fair value measurements of the investments. Corrected and uncorrected misstatements, there were none. I will say Brenda and her team do a good job of making sure we are given a clean set of financial statements when we begin our work, and we did not find any differences that would need to be posted to the financial statements. Also, as far as the quality of the financial reporting, we have no issues with the accounting policies or practices. Significant accounting estimates, we're in line with management on what those are. Financial statement presentations, alternative accounting treatments, nothing of that nature that was an issue. In the financial statements, I do want to mention this. We talked about it in the audit committee. We do have a partner that reads the financial statements once we have them all ready to go, separate from our audit team. We actually had the head of our government practice read through those, and he compliments the financial statements and what a great job management had done on preparing those. So I did want to share that with all of you. The results of our audit just kind of touches through the different areas that were in our planning communications. Internal controls, we do look at internal controls for the purposes of our planning procedures and risk assessments. We do not audit internal controls. So we take a fully substantive approach to the audit, but we still have to look at them. So I will say there were no issues noted related to internal controls. The actuarial valuation, this kind of summarizes some of the procedures, and we did not have any findings. We did use our own internal actuarial team to review the actuarial report. So no issues there. We also look at eligibility and benefit payments. No issues were identified there. Investments is the biggest bulk of the work we do in the audit. So this summarizes some of the procedures that we go through there. Ultimately, there were no issues identified with the valuation of the investments as reported. Other receivables, payables, and expenses, investment income, no issues there. Fraud, commitments, and contingencies and sub-events are other areas that we go through. And while we are not doing a fraud audit, we must consider fraud in our financial statement audit, and we do various procedures, including interviews of board members, management, other people with in the system to inform our ideas around the risk of fraud and perform certain procedures related to that. We did not identify anything during those procedures. Commitments and contingencies, we do also talk with legal. We get legal confirmations as well, and any disclosures are appropriate based on the work we've done there. And then we do also consider subsequent events, and if there's anything that needs to be reported there, that you'll see in that sub-event footnote. Reportable findings, internal control, as I mentioned, you know, we do look at your internal controls. This slide defines what those different categories would be, but I'm happy to report we did not find anything that needed to be reported here. The next few slides go through some of the required communications from the auditing standards. I will confirm we are independent of the system that is lined out in our engagement letter, but I will reconfirm that to you today. We are independent. There were no significant changes to our planned audit strategy or scope. Information we've obtained, no matters noted relevant to the audit from obtained from those others. Consultations, not aware of any consultations with other accountants on alternative accounting treatment. I did want to point out here on the use of specialized skills, where we, as I mentioned, we do have our actuaries that come in and help us review the actuarial reports, so we have those specialized skills. And we do also use BDO valuation in-house specialists to help us look at valuations of investments. So we did utilize those two groups. Let's see. And I think that's pretty much it. I won't read all the rest of this to you, but I am happy to take any questions you have.
Anyone have anything? I just want from a whole group compliment, you know, you two and the firm for being, you know, a great business partner in all this. Jill's got a big promotion, so there may be some changes in staffing you informed us, but people with a lot of skills and experience in that will still continue with this. So I want to say thank you, but I guess we have a technical thing to do. We need to have an a motion. Are you done with your comments now?
Okay.
So can we have a motion to approve the issuance of the 2022 audit report?
I'll make it.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. I guess I can compliment you now officially. That was not a official compliment.
Since replicated Siegel's 2023 valuation, And so we've updated our presentation and recommendations based on that. We want feedback, and then we will come back with a final report that goes to you, it goes to the city, and it goes to the Texas Pension Review Board. I should say the presentation we made to you in November, we also made to the ad hoc city council committee and to the pension review board. So they've all been briefed on the same information. Last time we showed you baseline projections based on the 2022 valuation, we had assumed a minus 13% return for the year. The return was slightly better than that, but these projections are very simple. The left side, the gray bars are showing the actuarial liability projected going forward. The teal line is the projection of the assets, and the numbers at the top are the funded status based on the actuarial value of assets. And so you can see that funded status was projected to decline down to the mid-20s under the current program. The right-hand side, we're showing the contributions, which are not terribly interesting on this chart because it's fixed at 34.5%. The first couple of years, it's a little bit higher because there's some temporary funding that's built in. The purple bars at the bottom are the member contributions, which are just fixed at 13.5% through the whole period. The black line there is the normal cost. That's the cost of benefits attributable to that year of service. So all of the contributions above that line are going to pay for the unfunded liability. We're going towards the unfunded liability. And the member and city contributions below that are paying for the benefits attributable to the current service. So we made three primary recommendations in the last meeting. The principal recommendations have not changed. We are providing some alternatives under each, particularly the first and third of the recommendations here. So the first and most important recommendation is to adopt an actuarially determined contribution that will allow you to adjust contributions as your situation changes and to always comply with Pension Review Board guidelines. One thing we wanted to clarify is when you switch from just being a fixed rate of pay to actuarially determined contributions that may change every year, there's a process about when you calculate those and when they go into effect. And so we are suggesting that the contributions start based on the January 1, 2023 valuation. You have to do some recalculations on it and become effective either at the beginning of the city's fiscal year, 10-1-2024, or the beginning of your plan year, 1-1-2025. So there's actually potentially a two-year lag between the date that it's measured and then calculated and when it becomes effective.
I just want to make sure, I've struggled over the years on actuarial, so I sort of presume nothing. And I just don't want us to move beyond step one about all of us. So if this is redundant, so be it. But does everyone understand that what this means is that every year covers its own weight? So you have 30 years to fund the liability plus cover the normal cost, and that you never allow yourself to get behind. So regardless of investment returns, regardless of everything else, the final plug is the contribution, the money in order to never get behind. Isn't that kind of the easiest way
yes,
to think about
that's
it?
That's a good high-level way to think about it. We'll go through some.
Are you saying the contributions are subpar and investments are subpar, then you're going to have to make up for it in this component?
Well, we're not saying, yeah, we're just saying that there's a, that it's the funding amount. If you adopt this, then the funder, whoever ends up being, ends up plugging the hole, yes.
So the ABC is recalculated every year?
Every year.
To account for the underperformance or overperformance of the...
Exactly. So now the key on that is we are smoothing the assets over 5 years. So if you have a really bad year or a really good year, you're only going to recognize 20% of that variation for each of the next 5 years. That helps smooth out that variation, but there will be variation and adjustments in the contribution amount each year.
But if you're doing multiple years of negative returns or subpar returns, then isn't that just, you're only accounting for 20%, and the following year
you're building
farther behind? So
you're building, right. So there's a balance. We didn't really prepare a discussion about this. But the idea of asset smoothing is to smooth volatility. But they can't smooth it over too long of a period because that's exactly the issue you're saying. If you have multiple bad years, you need to get to the new level of contributions. And so 5 years has been a standard within the actuarial community to manage that, so that it's long enough to smooth out the individual volatility of years, but short enough that if you have multiple bad years or multiple good years, that your contribution level transitions to the new appropriate levels.
And I mean, we're not bound by, I mean, that's a standard that makes sense, that does the test of time, but we're not bound by it. We're needing to come up, the board needs to come up with a plan that's our plan, relying on all the expert advice. I just wanted to make sure, because I know I've struggled over time on this stuff. ABC means the payment can fluctuate and you never get behind.
Are the factors that go into modeling of that number, or can either of those components be arguable? In other words, could that delay that number be input, like are these like fixed numbers going in, or is it sort of evaluated if there's a number that has a wiggle room where you can go back and forth and say, well, that number's not right, that number's not right. So we would have an issue with the funder of this, and so that it is a perpetual argument because one of these components are more subjective than.
Well, I would assume it's the assumptions that would be criticized, right?
Well, yes. So you've got the assumptions that your actuary is going to set and you adopt, and then you perform the valuation based on the data you have. We'll get into the pieces that could fluctuate in the future and the pieces that are fixed based on that valuation, but we are putting one piece that's based as a percentage of pay, so if their pay changes, that will change. And another piece that's a fixed dollar amount that does not change with their pay, and it's just a fixed amount, so they know what to budget for that.
But
the policies that develop those are what we're talking about here and would be adopted. Once those policies are adopted, I don't think there's no question about what the numbers are.
Right. I'm just trying to figure out.
Well, the things that, you know, we have a discount rate, and that would affect the liability.
Yes.
And Ryan is taking us to a traditional investment portfolio where a lot of the ambiguity of what things are worth and valued, that should diminish considerably over time if we take the investment portfolio to where he's taking it. So that's me or
the... That's one I'm a little worried about.
Other economic and demographic assumptions, and annually the board adopts what those assumptions are to be, and the actuary evaluates whether they're reasonable or not. And then every 5 years, an experience study happens where they actually look at how many deaths did we expect to happen, how many occurred, how many, what was turnover, what did we expect, what were raises, and then adjustments happen for that. So there's mechanisms in place to make sure we stay as close as we can. I mean, it's really impossible to know 30 years out what these numbers are going to be, but I think we're doing the recommended practice to get on the right assumption.
I just want to see how vulnerable we are to a lot of the issues with our the components that go into the ABC movie.
Right.
One of the top members said there's probably no dispute. I mean, they may not like the numbers. We've all presented numbers that boards choked on, but you know, if you got your methods and assumptions in place, it is what it is.
Yeah, one of the assumptions though that could be disputed is the discount rate, right? I mean, the assumption of the return is on the fund, and these are the rules we're doing it too low, so it's obviously the ADT in place, the ADT. So I'm just pointing out that could be a factor. That could be one of the factors that is disputed. The assumption is too low, and therefore it makes ADT higher.
Another question. When you presented to the Pension Review Board, were there any perspective or any value judgments reflected on the actuarial sound contribution?
I think everyone was in an agreement that going to an actuarially determined contribution was a good approach.
So they would sign off on that concept. And, okay.
Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I should have said this up front. We're going to go through a section on each of these three recommendations.
Okay.
And so we can have a lot more discussion on the ADC when we go through it and get to the end of that. And I think it would be good to interrupt and have that discussion.
Okay.
And then do the employee contribution piece and then the
I just want to make sure everyone knew what it
meant. I think that's very good. And there are, we are trying to hit the high points in our presentation. There's a little more detail in the appendix that we initially put in there mostly for other actuaries to read, but provide some more detail about our thoughts, and we can refer to that if needed. Our second primary recommendation is to reduce the employee contribution rate as the funding improves. The current rate is high as a proportion of the normal cost and the total benefit cost. But given your funded level, it doesn't make sense to us to reduce it now. We'll talk about it more, but it just would grade down as your funding level improves. The third is to provide some COLA earlier than the current provisions permit. And we'll go into a lot more detail on this one, so I'm not going to do too much right here. So, as I said, we'll do three sections here, and we'll start with the actuarially determined contribution and turn it to Elizabeth here.
Okay. So, here we're turning to the second recommendation and talking about the employee contributions and the ABC. And we're kind of visually showing what Bill already talked about in this graph. On the left side, we're showing the current structure. And under this, pretty much all of the contribution is based on pay, that 34.5% plus the small temporary payments that came from HB 3158. But in the graph on the right, what our recommendation is that we're proposing that only the cost that's related to that ongoing service, the normal cost that Bill talked about, is going to be based on the pay. And the amount that's needed to pay off the unfunded liability that relates to your past service, that's going to be fixed dollars. So, and this is just kind of key. We wanted to put this here to make sure that it's in everyone's mind, because when we get into graphs later looking at the contributions, we're showing the full contribution as a percentage, but that's just for comparison purposes. To make it easy, the development does have that part of the UAL, the paying down the unfunded, as dollar amounts. So I'll give it back to Phil. I'm going to talk to
Let me jump in here. Just one other point on why we're doing this is we saw there's the actuary's assumption on what payroll will increase. There's the city's budget assumption on what payroll will increase and those sorts of things. And this approach really takes that out of the equation makes the payroll piece a much smaller part of the contribution. It makes certain that you are collecting the UAL payments you need to pay off that unfunded liability. And it's not subject to what the city does in terms of adding more employees or not hiring employees. So it gives you some certainty on that end. It also makes it clear to the city that if they want to hire 300 more officers, the burden of doing that is really just that normal cost rate because it does not affect the amount you need to collect on the unfunded liability. So they're not saying adding another officer, they have to add 50% to their pay as the cost of doing that. So it just cleans up some of those pieces. Turn it to Jake to talk about the timing.
So Bill talked a little bit about the timing of when the valuation is completed and when the contribution comes into effect. And so this just kind of tries to visualize the timeline of it. And so the first actuarially determined contribution would be based on the 1/1/2023 valuation date. That's the measurement date. However, the valuation isn't generally completed until the end of the year. And so the valuation, we're saying the timeline is completed around 1/1/2024. So at that point, the actuarially determined contribution is known. And the city would start contributing that actuarially determined contribution either 9 months later, starting in October, or 12 months later, starting 1/1/2025. Projections are assuming 1/1/2025 just for ease of calculations, but the difference between 10/1/24 and 1/1/25 are very, immaterial. So the timeline of when the evaluation is completed around the beginning of 2024 gives the city 9 to 12 months to budget and prepare for that contribution tax coming up. Of course, the 2023 valuation doesn't include all of the changes that are potentially going to be adopted by the board. So there might need to be some adjustments to the existing valuation report, but the measurement date is still in effect there. And so a more practical example, if we look at the next year, the 1/1/2024 valuation will be completed around the end of 2024, and at that point, the city will know how much that contribution is, and they will start contributing that either 9 or 12 months later, either October of 2025 or at the beginning of 2026, just to help kind of give you an idea of the 2023 evaluation calculates the contribution that the city is going to pay in 2025, and the 2024 evaluation is going to calculate the contribution the city is going to pay in 2026. So there's about a 2-year lag between when the technology measured and when the payment begins. And that's pretty typical for plans that pay an ADC. There needs to be a lag because the amount is not known on the measurement basis. It takes a while to gather information, calculate the amount, and then there's some time necessary for the contributing entity to budget the plan for the contribution.
So it doesn't say this, but it implies that if you follow the schedule that if you began October 1st of this year, the payments through October 1st of 2025 would be based on the 2023 valuation.
Yep.
Then you would adjust the payments a year later, whatever is the updated information.
Correct. The payment would be made for any 12-month period, and then the next 12-month period it would be updated.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that's how every year when there's more experience, there's liability or asset gains and losses, that actuarially determined contribution is updated each year to adjust as the plan has experience emerging.
That makes sense. All right. So in looking at the ADCs and the options that we're presenting for it, we just wanted to lay out some of the principles we were applying. And so the baseline principle is we really need to meet the Pension Review Board funding guidelines, which means we need to have a funding period of 30 years or less. So the starting, we need to be fully amortized within 30 years. The second principle was with an ADC, the preferred approach is to go to what's called layered amortization. And so each year, you actually look at the change that happened that year, and you set up a separate schedule to pay for that change. And so that you can track those changes from year to year. By controlling the length of the amortization, you can control the volatility that happens in that contribution. The third piece was to provide some budget accommodations, because we know we're starting at a level much lower than what we need to get to. And so we wanted to provide some adjustment time to get from where we are to where we need to be. And then we're also looking at the end of that, because these nine contributions are not going to last forever. They may seem like they're going to last forever, but they won't last forever. And then the final thing, all of our options actually have a mechanism to transition to a 20-year period. So you're starting at a 30-year period, but this would transition to a 20-year period, which is really, really kind of the gold standard within our practice, is a 15 to 20 year amortization period. And so that helps, at 20 years, that helps control the ongoing volatility out in the future. And what that means, what it really means is if you had a big loss 20 years from now, that is not being amortized over the remaining 10 years of the initial 30-year period. It's being spread over another 20 years, so it can extend beyond. And so when you get to the end of that 30-year period, you're not having to make up for any gains or losses in a really short time. It's always going to be 20 years going out.
Hey, whoever's on the phone, we're getting a lot of noise. If you all could mute it at your end. Thanks.
So I'm not sure if that makes sense to you, but it will take us 10 years before that starts having any effect. But if you're looking out at these projections and thinking, what's going to happen in 20, 25 years if we have a big gain or loss, this helps control that volatility in the contribution, keeps it within bounds. So we've modeled five different actuarially determined contributions. All of them we consider reasonable. All of them get you within the Pension Review Board guidelines, and all have the characteristics we've been describing. They vary in how they handle the pattern of contributions and what the effect is. We label them least preferred to most preferred based on how quickly they get money into the plan. Because given your funding level, the sooner you can get money in, the better. On the left side is a traditional approach, which is you take your entire unfunded liability and you say, we're just going to pay that over 30 years, and you set up a level payment. That gets a significant, we'll show you in a second, that gets you quite a bit of increase in contribution immediately, which may not be practical, but would be great if you could start receiving a much higher contribution immediately. Given the practicalities of adjusting the budget, we have the two middle ones are a three-year step up and step down, or a five-year step up and step down. And what we've done here is we set up one amortization that's meant to essentially match the current contribution level and continue that for 30 years. And that's about $2.2 billion that we're amortizing there. And then the remainder of the unfunded liability, we put on a special schedule that steps up over either a 3 or 5 year period from where we are now to an ultimate level and then holds that until the end of the amortization period and then steps down.
Well, what does that 2.5% represent?
The 2.5% is the current assumption both for inflation and for payroll growth.
Okay.
And so if you think of your current rate as 34.5% of pay, if pay grows 2.5% a year, the dollar amount is going to increase 2.5% a year. And so we're following that similar pattern here. The last two options only do the step up at the beginning and don't step down at the end. We'll talk a little bit more about the step down at the end and why we prefer that, but the differences you'll see are really relatively minor.
Is the step down the vehicle by which the employee contribution could decrease, or the step
down? No, that's separate. This was the step down the city's contribution. And the general idea is significant changes in the contribution level disrupt the city budget. And that works very much as it's going up, but it also works as you're going down. You suddenly eliminate a huge payment in the city's budget that can be disruptive. And so it can be more easier to manage if you have built in a plan to step that down over a few years. I'm going to turn it to Elizabeth to show you the chart.
Okay, so now we're going to look at forecast modeling these different variations on that first recommendation of having an actuarial determined contribution. These graphs here are the same format that Bill introduced, where we're looking at the relationship between the liability and the assets in the graph on the left, and the contributions on the right. Again, we're expressing them as percentage of pay for comparison purposes. So one thing we want to note is in all of these five scenarios we're about to talk about, the fund is forecasted to be 100% funded, fully funded, by the 2055 date. So focusing on the graph on the right, and note that the contribution jumps up at 2025 due to that timing that Jake talked about as we move to the new plan, and also recognizing the smoothing of the assets for the already experienced asset gains and losses. So because of those things, we want to kind of focus on the 2029 year, just for orienting a little bit here. And so in this scenario, which is that traditional ADC with no ramps, at 2029, it goes up, and you've got a 50% rate shown in this scenario. Then we look at the modifications, so going on to the next slide, 1B. Here it's a similar thing, but we've varied this traditional ADC by adding in both a three-year phase-in to gradually increase the contribution, as well as similar at the end of the period. And here, that 2029 year that I was highlighting is now at 52%. And it's going to be slightly higher because you're recognizing that period that the smoothing results in lower contribution. So there's less funds coming into the plan. And as a result, over the period of this, you know, 30-year period, in general, the contributions are higher by about 1 to 2% versus the traditional ADC. The funding ratio doesn't really change much. There's slight drops, particularly in the early periods, but they're all pretty similar. Then on C, it's the same kind of setup, but instead of doing three-year periods, we're giving more time to minimize that budget disruptive effect by going to 5 years. It's very similar, but here that 2029 number goes up another 1% to 53% because you've got to make up for that money that's not coming in because of the ramps. Right, then we go to four, and this is similar to 1B, but because we're keeping the modification of ramping up, but we've removed the ramping down at the end. So at the end of the period, it just goes from the high level off of a cliff down to the normal cost. And the fifth, that 2029 year is at 51% versus what we saw two versions before in 1B. And so it's, you know, 1% lower, recognizing that you don't have that phase down at the end. And last, just really quickly, because 5 years is a lot, this is the 5-year ramp up with no ramp down. And in this one, that 2029 year is 52%. I know that's a lot to dig in, so we've also put together some information looking at these comparatively, and I'll give it back to Bill to look at that.
Yeah, so you can see there are differences between the different options, but they are relatively minor compared to what we've been looking at. We tried to give you some summary items here so that you could think through what the different options mean. And so in the upper left corner, we show the how low does the funding percentage get. And so with that traditional option where you jump the contributions in, the contribution rate goes up immediately, it only goes down to 34% funded if you're getting 6.5% returns every year. All the other options, it goes a little bit lower, 32%, because we're delaying the contributions. But the difference between the 3-year and 5-year is pretty minor in terms of what happens there. The year you reach 70% funded, we targeted this because that's when COLAs would become payable. It's either 2047 or 2046, depending on the scenario. It's interesting, with the step down, the middle years actually have a slightly higher contribution rate, so it actually reaches the 70% threshold slightly earlier, but the differences are pretty minor, and whether it's 2046 or 2047 is going to be really much more varied based on your actual investment returns than the methodology. In the lower left corner, at the Pension Review Board, there was a question about the negative net cash flow and how that affects you. We wanted to point out, under all of these methods, your negative net cash flow position gets much better very quickly. So you've been running, or you're currently running at about minus 7%. Net cash flow, so contributions versus benefit payments as a percentage of your total assets. So you've got a net outflow of about 7% of assets currently. But when we ramp up contributions, that really changes that perspective, which affects everything from the liquidity needed in the investment portfolio to the dynamics of what happens with individual years of investment returns.
And everyone remember here that we have funded that the last 6 or 7 years with private equity monetization. So we were slugging more than 100% of that. We funded it as we whittled our way out of these private assets. But the ability to do that going forward, absent any change, is we don't know. We're down to the last couple assets. So we've had a way that's been, I don't want to say painless, but we had a solution for it. But going forward, absent any other change, we would probably have to start reducing good assets to fund that shortfall. So that's what this is speaking to. So it's about like $9 million a month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as you're getting more contributions, that will ease that pressure significantly. And all of them are projected to actually get to a positive net cash flow eventually.
Okay. It looks like, just looking at the graph, doesn't matter which plan you choose here, you get to zero net in 2035, so 10 years in basically?
Yes.
Okay.
On the right-hand side, we tried to capture the 2 years that Elizabeth was pointing to. The first year, 2025, is in the top part of the chart, and then 2029, when all the ramps are done is in the bottom part of the chart. And so you can compare the differences. The normal cost rate is shown in the dark green. That's the part that would be subject to actual payroll. And then the light green, we're showing the dollar amounts because we would be setting the ADC as a dollar amount for that portion of it. And so you can see the different methods, it's somewhat intuitive that if you jump things up right away on the traditional, that's obviously the highest contribution in 2025. But because you've done that, then the ongoing contribution when you get to 2029, that's the lowest. And so they vary with the step-up period. The three-year step-ups are higher in 2025 and lower in 2029 compared to the five-year step-ups. And then if you have to step down at the end, it's going to be slightly higher in 2029 because you've got to pre-fund the time when you're cutting contributions at the end of the day. So does that make sense in sort of what the trade-offs are between the different methods? Okay, any more questions on the ADC before we move to another area?
Yeah,
we can come back to them at the yes, our rationale. So just to wrap up, we think all of these options are reasonable. So there are differences, but they're all reasonable. They all meet the Pension Review Board guidelines. One of the critical things is they adjust contributions as circumstances change. And that includes during the ramp-up period. I know there's been discussion about doing the ramp-ups as fixed dollars. We're a little concerned about that because you could, if you were doing a five-year ramp-up, you could ramp up 4 years at fixed dollar amounts, but the intervening period, the ultimate level could change, and you could have a big jump at the end. And so we think it's important to build that into the ADC so that it adjusts the ramp based on your experience as you go up. They're all expected to achieve 70% funding in 2046 or 2047. I think under the current valuation, it's 2073. So that changes things. And as we talked about last time, bringing that date closer actually increases your liability. So when you adopt this, one of the strange things is you'll see an increase in the liability and valuation. And that's just because the COLA would be expected to be paid soon. Of the methods, given the current funded status, we do prefer getting to higher contributions as soon as possible. So that's kind of how we ordered them in terms of our preference. And I know there's also been talk about lump sum contributions. We have not specifically put lump sum contributions in here, but the ADC methodology takes those into account. So when you receive a lump sum, it would automatically restructure the amount of the contribution. And we've put in the appendix our thoughts on how you would do that specifically for a lump sum, because you do have some choices on what you prioritize. But any lump sum contribution would just reduce the future actuarially determined contributions. We do think it's reasonable to manage the change to a higher level of contributions. We prefer the step-up, step-down options. The step-up gives the city a chance to adjust their budgets gradually. Similarly, the step-down gives them a chance at the end to adjust that. And one of the reasons we put that in now, you can obviously do it later, but it, just in our experience, most of the entities that we work with and that I work with, for sure, when they have reached that cliff, the sponsor actually has raised an issue about going off the cliff and reducing the contribution by so much in 1 year. The problem with dealing with it later is often the solution requires you to extend the amortization period so that you can grade it down. So we do think it's better to plan for it in advance, but it wouldn't be required to plan for it 30 years in advance, but we do think that that's a better approach. Okay, now I'm done with the ABC. If anyone has any questions.
I have a question. You recommend, when at the beginning of this, you said you would recommend the employee contribution amount go down.
That's the next section.
I'm sorry, okay. I'll wait for that.
Let's go through that, and then you can, as it ties back to the ABC, we can tie it back.
Why don't we let we'll go through that and the whole
sure.
thing?
Sure. We'll do that later.
Because they both interconnect, all three interconnect,
sure.
and we'll kind of hit the question.
Okay, I'm going to turn it to Elizabeth to go through the employee.
Okay, so as Phil said, now we're going to move into exploring that second recommendation related to the level of the employee contributions. So here we're looking at our recommendation to gradually decrease that rate for the new member group. This is actually similar to what's in your current statute. It just reduces these earlier under the current statute. The reduction would come into play when you're fully funded. And in this scenario, what the contributions from the employees are is 50% of the normal costs, rounded, which is here 9.5%, plus an adjustment amount. And in the table below, we give the values of these adjustments that we're modeling. They range from a high value of 4%, which is what we have currently, that produces the 13.5% rate, and that would be in effect as long as the funded ratio is under 50%. And then that adjustment amount decreases until ultimately it reaches 0%, and the employee contribution would just be 50% of the normal cost for the 9.5 at the point at which the funded ratio is 90% or better. So let's look at what happens. Here we're modeling what was labeled as scenario 1C before, and this is the 5-year up and down with the adjustable employee rate. The graph on the right is the same as we've been seeing all day, but we've added a extra graph here because we want to focus in on what happens with this, because this is really just impacting the normal cost. It doesn't change anything with those UAL payments, the amounts to pay down your unfunded. And what changes is the division of the normal cost, which has been shown by that black line all along, between the members and the city. And you'll see this kind of gradual fade down as you're going from the 13.5% as long as the funded ratio is under 50%, until it starts decreasing with about 2039 in this case, until ultimately at the end of the period where you've reached that fully funded status, the contributions are down to 9.5%. The only thing we really want to note on, yeah, sorry, that is it.
So it's just a shift from the member contributing 13.5 to gradually contributing half of the value of their benefit that they're earning, and the city would cover the other half. There's no change in the total amount that the system would receive. It's just the member would pay slightly less and the city would pay slightly more portion of that normal cost amount.
And we're just showing it with the one to spare you from having a whole other five of these, but obviously this could be combined with any of the others.
Okay, so now we want to talk about the COLA. So just for some background, you used to have a COLA that was an automatic 4% simple COLA if you were hired prior to 2007 and ad hoc if you were hired after that. It was changed to one that depends on investment returns, not inflation. So estimates based on the five-year average return minus 5%. So your expected return is 6.5. We'd expect the five-year average to be 6.5. You subtract 5%, that means the expected COLA when it applies would be about 1.5%. There's a maximum in any year of 4%, and it can only be granted if the funded percentage is greater than 70% after the COLA. So that, under your current funding, is projected to be 2073, with the revised funding plan is about 2046 or 2037. So the length of time with no COLA concerned us a bit, because your members are not covered by Social Security, so they have no part of their retirement income. It is inflation protected. And so we want to talk about what that means and introduce some concepts and then give you some potential solutions. The chart on the right introduces this concept of purchasing power. The idea is, at the time you retire, your retirement benefit pays for a certain amount of purchases. As time goes by, that power of that check to purchase things erodes depending on what inflation is. And so here, we're projecting it out with assuming 2.5% inflation each year, looking at different COLAs. And if you look at the bottom line, the blue line, that's with no COLA. And so after 15 years, your purchasing power has eroded to 69%. So that's, it's like if you started with a $1,000 a month check, after 15 years, that $1,000 a month check would be equivalent to have started with a $690 a month check at the beginning, in terms of the goods that you could purchase with. If you paid the 1.5% simple COLA each year, that's the gold line, and after 15 years with the 2.5% inflation, you would still have declined down to about 86%. The green line is what if you had a 2.5% simple COLA. So inflation actually acts in a compound way. At 2.5% each year compounds on it, but the COLAs are set up as simple. So there's some erosion that still happens with the simple, and after 15 years, you would have a drop of about 4% in the purchasing power. Now that green line is equivalent to the employee's retirement fund COLA. And your COLA is currently at the blue line when you're 70% funded, then that's the gold line based on expectations. Now, COLAs are very expensive, so we do not want to hide from that. We have to recognize. So why would you even think about a COLA when you are so poorly funded? So there's a lot of good arguments to not increase the COLA that are built around the costs of the system. The COLAs will require additional contributions. If you adopt them now, it will drop your funded percentage immediately. And so it's a natural response to just exclude any consideration of COLA improvements while we're facing this situation and trying to recover the funded status. However, our concern is, can Dallas really maintain its police and fire workforce if it doesn't pay a COLA over the next 20 or more years? Is that going to become a recruitment and retention issue if it isn't already? Given the lack of Social Security indexation and comparisons to other And so if you believe COLA is going to be needed in the next 20 years, we think you should figure out what it is now and build it into the budget so that you are not ignoring it and deferring the costs of something that you know you're going to have to include later. And so we here are outlining some options that run the spectrum from your current COLA up to the COLA of the employees. We are not recommending any specific option because it is really a cost-benefit trade-off. That there's no specific actuarial answer to. It's a policy decision for you to make. These aren't exhaustive of options, so there's a lot of nuance and detail you can go through to look at different things, but we wanted to give you a spectrum and introduce a couple of new ideas. Not going to go in too much detail here, but we tried to outline some of the things to think about in designing a COLA. The first one is whether it should be based on actual inflation or investment returns, because retirees' living expenses vary with actual inflation. But on the other hand, the resources to pay for the COLA depend on investment returns. And so that they don't necessarily align, and so thinking about that balance is important. Simple versus compound. I mentioned inflation compounds. Most of the systems around here use simple COLAs. They are less expensive. The funded status requirement, I think, kind of speaks for itself. The new piece I want to talk about is a purchasing power protection provision. So if you have, you can insert a purchasing power protection provision that sets a floor on how far down a retiree's purchasing power can go from the time they retire. And so the effect will vary based on the year of retirement. And so, for example, if you set a floor of 70%, if you looked at that graph we showed earlier, you would still continue to go down, but once someone hit 70%, you would start providing COLAs equal to actual inflation so that they never went any further down. It just gives them a baseline level of protection. It won't result in the same COLAs for every retiree every year because it varies based on their year of retirement. How much their benefit has eroded due to inflation. But it provides that base level protection. The last one, when you're designing it, there's usually an expected amount based either on your inflation assumption, your investment return assumption, or whatever. And often there's a maximum, there are variations you can work with that. So just as a reminder, the two ends of the spectrum we're looking at, I just went through this for both of the systems. The police and fire system is based on investment returns, five-year average return minus 5%, but you have to be 70% funded to get a COLA. The employee's retirement fund is a simple COLA equal to CPI with a cap, 5% for most of the current retirees, but for people hired after 2016, the cap is 3%. So we modeled a bunch of COLA options. We aren't going to go through all of them. We put a bunch in the appendix. We wanted to give you a flavor. We'll start with looking at the current COLA and then the employees' retirement fund COLA. We showed you the immediate partial COLA idea at the last presentation. We aren't going to go through that, but it's in the appendix. We want to look at the two that add the purchasing power protection, either at 70% or 80%, and then the last two are in the appendix. So we have a new chart to orient you to. So let me try and explain what's going on here. So we're looking at the purchasing power based on the year of retirement on the left-hand side. And so let me start with the row for people who retired in 2023. So going across the top there. In 2024, we would say their purchasing power is 100%. That's where they're starting. In 5 years, given 2.5% inflation and no COLAs in your current because you're not 70% funded, we would expect that to have dropped to 88%. And similarly, another 4 or 5 years to 78%. And continuing on, so that 30 years after retirement, they would be down to about 56%.
And that reflects the 1.5% COLA coming into play around 2046.
Yes.
So these percentages do reflect the COLA coming into effect around 2046.
Now, that, the starting point for everyone is different. So if you look at that 2024 column and go down, based on the year of retirement, some people have already incurred erosion. And we calculated these based on the Dallas area CPI compared to the COLA that was granted. So you had COLAs granted through 2016 and no COLAs since then. And so the purchasing power varies, the starting point varies based on that past experience. Now, there aren't very many people in your plan still who retired in 1980, they have a pretty low purchasing power compared to others, partly because of the experience in the 80s. Now, for so this reflects how, this is kind of our baseline given your current number of how much the purchasing power declines for these different groups as we move forward in time.
And just note that after 2015, on the retirement years, we're showing 5 years, we go 2015, yeah. 2010, and every 5 years thereafter.
All right. I'm going to do the purchasing power piece, and Jake's going to tell you what the cost impact is.
So this is, again, your current COLA provision. So it's a projection you've already seen, but I just want to remind you of the cost. Again, we're using the five-year step-up, step-down scenario on the ADC. You'll note the in 2029, the ADC gets to 53% of pay, and again, the system gets to 100% funded by 2055.
So going to the other extreme, if we did the employee's retirement fund COLA, you can see that it doesn't completely keep up with the inflation, but it stays fairly close. So the numbers in the 2024 column all decline gradually as time goes on and you move to the right.
And Bill, this is for the Tier B people, not the Tier A. So the Tier A people would look a lot better,
based on the assumptions, it actually doesn't matter because we're only assuming 2.5% inflation.
Oh, okay. But a lot more.
But yes, the Tier A people would be generally better off because they could deal with more volatility.
The downside to the employee plan COLA is that it's very expensive. As you can see here in slide 32, the ultimate contribution rate in 2029 would be 70% of pay instead of 53%. That is a notable increase in the cost because this benefit is, this COLA is very expensive. So that is cost is floating in between those two. Worth noting, in addition to the 70% of pay contribution, the funded ratio immediately drops to the 33% because there is an additional liability associated with this. So in addition to higher costs, you're going to have an increase in liability and it's going to drop your funded percentage.
So in these examples, you're not showing the, you're not overlaying the potential decrease in the employee contribution over time.
Correct.
Right. So it's not the math that doesn't allow you to do it. You just took that variable out.
Yes.
So would you run that so we can see that, so we can see the mix of all three as a follow up, and then Kelly, send that to the board.
I think you'll see very minor differences. The total contributions that go into the plan don't change. It's just the shift between and you'll notice on the chart on the left, you start at a lower funded percentage, but because the contributions are ratcheted up, the point at which you get to 70% does not change that much.
Okay.
But there will be some slight differences in that.
And this, because there's so many factors here, but this particular, this looks at, when we talk about COLA, are we also looking at what about the statute in the sense that it's more investment driven, inflation driven?
So not in this scenario. This scenario is a COLA that's based on actual CPI. It's based on actual CPI. The only reason that it doesn't keep up with CPI in this scenario is because it's simple and actual CPI is compound. And so that's why it stays very close for a good period of time.
That's just, it shows a contrast. If I get started, we're not looking at CPI, we're looking at investment and we're looking for recommendations for our.
Well, that would be up to you.
Okay.
But every other scenario, every other scenario we are showing is based on the way, on the investment returns, the way your CPI or your COLA currently is structured.
Okay. Josh, one point of clarification. Based on the statute, if we were to adopt a plan that conforms, that incorporated a COLA, we need the legislature to opine on that since it's spoken or addressed in statute?
I don't believe so, but we'll talk about that.
Okay, all right. So
yeah.
All right.
Okay, so now we're looking at a scenario where we have your current COLA with the 70% funded status restriction, but we are adding to it a purchasing power protection equal to 70% of the 2024 purchasing power. So what that means, if you look at the top row here, it follows the same pattern as yours, except in 2039, it hits 70% and then stays at 70%. So that's saying in approximately 15 years, your COLA would go from no COLA for that group of retirees to a full inflation COLA in order to hold them at 70%. It takes about 15 years for the new retirees. Now, to control the cost, we treated everyone who's retired before 2023 as if they retired in 2023 for this calculation.
So you wouldn't make up the where they drop below 70%?
Right. So for example, someone who retired in 2017 had 79%, is starting at 79% purchasing power in 2024. We're not holding them to 70%. We're holding them to 70% of 79%. Mm. So So it drops, so they're still projected to drop to 55% before we hold them harmless.
Is that 70% done by other, is that just an arbitrary number or is that?
Other systems I've seen generally have in the range of 75 to 85%, but we wanted to give you one that gets this concept in at a lower cost. So that's why we're going to show you the 80% as well, just to, so you can see the impact of that cost and the impact that it would have on the balance.
So going through the cost and the projection, the 2029 contribution rate is up to 55% in this scenario. Your current COLA provision, it was 53%, so about a 2% increase in the city's contribution rate to adopt this 70% purchasing power protection. The funded ratio in the current year drops slightly, again, because of slightly higher liabilities, but that's all made up in the higher contributions, and you ultimately get to 100% at the end of the projection period. So it's really just about a 2% increase in the city's contribution rate for the scenario.
I do want to, I'm not sure I made this clear, but so people who retire in the future, like in 2025, they would still be looking at a 15-year period before they would get the purchasing power protection. So it'd be like expected to be 15 years after they retire. And so that's part of what helps hold the costs down, is you're only covering some retirees in 15 years, and then you'd add more in 16 years to more than 17 years.
So wait, for example, some of the older retirees that have been retired for some time.
So now, if we do the same thing but provide 80% purchasing power protection, instead of being 15 years out, we expect it to be about 10 years out that we start providing the inflationary COLAs to hold their purchasing power. And so you can see for that 2017 example, they still drop down to about 63% because that's 80% of the 79%. But the current retirees would be held protected at the 80%
And when we look at the projected cost, that 2029 contribution goes up to 59% compared to the 53 for your current COLA, 55 for the 70% versus our protection. Another decrease in the current funding ratio, and made up with additional contributions, you always get back to that 100% in 2055 in these scenarios.
What's the dollar impact of that differential between those percentages?
There's a chart. And we're
going
to
yeah.
Great question. Next slide.
Thank you. So we didn't go through all the COLA options. They're in the appendix, but they're summarized here in terms of the cost. And so you can see we're looking at the projected 2029 city contribution. And you can see how both the normal cost rate and the UAL payment are affected by the So with the full employees retirement plan COLA, that would increase the normal cost rate to 2% and the UAL payment to almost $320 million from $245 million. All the others are steps in between, affecting both the normal cost rate and the UAL payment. And so you can see the different effects for that 70% purchasing power. The UAL payment is about $256 million versus $145 million. And there's also a 30 basis point increase in the normal cost rate. The right-hand side at the top, we're showing the purchasing power for that 2023 retiree, that top line of all the charts, so that you can compare what the impact is of each of the options on their purchasing power for new retirees and how that plays out. The bottom, we're showing the immediate impact to the UAL. Under the current, the UAL would be about $3.2 billion with the new funding plan, so it's slightly different than what was shown in the valuation. If you went all the way to the ERF COLA, it would be about $4.1 billion. The others are in between, with the 70% at about 3.4 and the 80% at about 3.6. The right-hand side shows the immediate impact on the 100%.
So, Bill, just make sure I'm reading the chart on the left. That's the 2029 year, and we did that year because that's after any phase up. And between now and then, there's going to be raises and, you know, hiring and all of that. So if we stick with the current COLA, the city, or the current COLA and the ADC, the city would pay $245 million.
Plus 6%.
But if they adopt the, let's just say, 70% protection, it would be another $10 million plus whatever the change is. Is that correct?
Yes. And so this was built off that five-year grade up scenario. So the other scenarios would be slightly different.
So it's not right to compare kind of where we are today to be, because you're going to snap.
No, you need to look at the 2029 to compare the impact of the COLA.
Okay.
And we're again showing split between that the normal cost is the percentage that's being impacted, and then the payment on the unfunded is in dollars.
For a plan that's been a fixed rate plan for so long, it can be hard sometimes to wrap your head around the change from a fixed rate percent of pay to a dollar amount, understandably.
I think we can get there pretty darn fast.
So just to wrap up our thoughts on this, and then we'd love to hear some discussion and thoughts and feedback. COLAs are expensive. You can see that in our projections. They are expensive, and often they're not appreciated for how expensive they are. And so when times get tough, they're often the first thing cut. If you look at the reaction across the country to the Great Recession, a lot of systems cut their COLAs because that was the easiest. Sometimes it was a legal restriction, but it's also often not appreciated. So you get, in terms of appreciation, you get a pretty good bang for the buck. But the fundamental question that we came to is, can Dallas maintain its police and fire workforce while offering no COLA for the next 20 years? And we've shown you what that does with their reduction in purchasing power for current and future retirees. They have no Social Security coverage, and we've shown you what the employees fund is paying. But our sense is that you can't go 20 plus years without some COLA. We don't know what level of COLA you would have to do, but rather than waiting to have those costs added on later, while we're developing this plan, we think it makes sense to take an assessment and decide what COLA you think you would have to pay, and let's build that into the plan and budget for it now. That doesn't prevent you from making a change to it in the future, but we get concerned that it's a somewhat known cost in the future that you'll have to do it, and if you're not building the financing for it, then it's going to become a bigger burden later to add in. So while you're taking a full assessment of your system, we think now's the time to consider consider it and build it into the plan. So again, we tried to outline a range of options with cost and benefit trade-offs. Those aren't the only ones. So we'd be interested in hearing what your thoughts are so we could help refine any of those as needed. We aren't recommending any specific option. It is really a policy decision and not an actuarial decision.
Okay. So you're kind of done then with the formal. Okay. Jeff, do you have just, knowing that the role you play, do you have any thoughts or comments or any observations based upon this before we open it up to the group?
I mean, it's definitely plausible. I guess my thoughts on the amortization, I prefer the traditional, they prefer what if it's budget friendly. More money you put in now, less you have to put in later.
Yeah.
But keep in mind, in this case, a lot needs to go in. So I really like the reducing the employee contribution rate over time. That can.
Okay. And you'll run schedules that combine all three on that. I'd like to make a comment, and I've never done this before. So my expectation was this going to be a little bit more of a numbers spreadsheet exercise. And I got to tell you, I am incredibly impressed that you guys have incorporated reality, real people, common sense, all those things that go beyond numbers on a computer. I think you've given us, you've taken something that, to me is a molecular formula of lots of symbols and all that, and you basically untangled it, and now I understand what are the core elements that comprise this very complicated thing, and I know I feel much more knowledgeable and empowered to deliberate with everyone else and try to come to a great solution. So, I can tell you I'm incredibly impressed with how you thought through this, and this morning has been a great learning experience for me. And I think we have a lot then that we can deliberate on going forward. So what other people think?
Just a lot of moving parts. And there's a lot of policy to this jump because, to your point, which I think is very valid and very smart point, is that we do have, if this is a new plan, that we're responsible for doing that with policy. And in doing that, if we don't recognize that the contribution numbers have to be bigger as well as COLA, then we don't do our job. So, it's been short term, like bad things that they do, and those are bad words. But it's our fiduciary duty to really consider that in constructing the plan going forward. So, what you're saying, what you've given the information for, is very important for our decision making, and it's a lot.
I concur. We're in an environment today where demographics and attraction of people into the labor force are going to change dramatically. And anything that we can offer, COLAs are expensive. That's a fact of life. Whether it's a funding ratio of 70% or less is negotiated. But bottom line, Social Security is probably going to run out in 2037. That's the latest forecast. So, granted, there will be additional expenses thrown on to try and keep it alive, but if we can offer a COLA and go through the process that's palatable to all the different parties that are involved, I think it's a benefit, and it's something where we can continue to attract good folks and into the force and our group.
Yep.
Okay. Now, the meeting this afternoon, are you all presenting as well?
Yes.
Streamlined version of it.
Yeah, probably a streamlined version of it.
Yeah, so I think it's just an hour and a half, so we.
Well, it actually changed a little bit. Purchasing 15 was the budget.
Okay.
I had a question.
question, and feel free to say you'll get back with me on that. Because I was going to call you and give you a fair warning, but I forgot to do that. At the PRB meeting, one of the members of the actuarial committee raised the idea of doing a COLA that somehow took drop into consideration. And I know you don't have that data. Have you thought at all about whether that's a worthwhile calculation or just too complicated given our drop and all that?
So I think the reaction was that with the drop, there was concern that maybe some of those members didn't need the COLA as much as other members. Mm-hmm. And I think our position really is that's not something for us to separate out. That's something for someone else to decide, you know, which members or how some sort of adjustment should be made. We do not have the data, as we talked, but we could certainly go through the data, but we want some direction about what we were trying to accomplish there. There is a little bit of a different effect in what we are proposing just because we're freezing the purchasing power that already exists. So some of the people who benefited most from the drop provisions have already had some reduction. The other thing I should have clarified, all the COLA we're talking about does not affect the current payments on drop accounts. Those are just fixed. So it's just the regular annuity payments. So, you know, I guess in summary, if that's a road that you want to go down, we can help you sort through the data and look at it. But it's not something that we thought was really appropriate for us to try and sort out.
Do you have other plans that kind of slice and dice their population like that? Because to me, it would be really complicated because, you know, some people chose to take a lower benefit and go into drop sooner, and some people went into drop and took their money, and some people are getting annuitized, and everybody's in a different situation.
Right.
I think it would be hard to do that.
That's partly why we don't want to.
Most of the times when they slice and dice, it's not based on what sort of payment form they took or things. It's just based on how long they've been retired and what the different inflation impact has been on their benefits. The other is sometimes there's a slight difference between disability versus normal retirement, but at least I haven't worked with anyone who somehow does this based on payment form, and I definitely would want counsel to look at it.
There are some that differentiate based on benefit level, but again,
yeah,
that adds a lot of complexity to the administration, and it's still a very crude adjustment because benefit level is affected principally by service as well as income, so you get some kind of weird dynamics.
Thank you.
Kelly, just one clarification. PRB, the question is about the drop in the COLA. What exactly was that? Were they talking about adding a COLA to the annuitized?
No. They were, I think the way I interpreted it, maybe I was wrong, is that they basically would say something like, well, if you had a drop or your drop was over X dollars, then you would be eligible for a COLA.
Okay.
So you'd end up, you know, you'd have to make rules and you'd have winners and losers, and it was that.
Okay.
Yeah, and you have the complexity that some people took a lump sum. And, yeah, so it's not a trivial thing for them.
Definitely the complexity of managing that lump sum and kind of the investment in things, which that's hard to do.
So I know this is a lot, and the next step is you all think about this, and then we'll come back later with a final version. So if you have thoughts about additional analysis you'd like to see or scenarios you'd like or not, get with me. I'll make sure we don't violate any open meeting laws, but just let me know your feedback if you need more information from Chiron or from Jeff, or if something here makes more sense to you than something else here, that would be helpful.
I just have a question, not necessarily, but in the ERF proposal that I've been presenting, is there any adjustment to the current COLA in their proposal?
No, the ERF is, they're just lifting the cap off of the city contribution. They're actually putting a cap on the employee contribution that doesn't currently exist.
But no changes to COLA?
No changes in any of the benefits of the COLA.
Do you guys have any idea of what percentage of plans in Texas or public safety plans in Texas have a COLA?
So public safety, some of them are delayed, and there are a lot less than there used to be. San Antonio has the most generous one at 75% of CPI, and they also have some mechanisms where they can get 13th and even 14th checks based on their returns. The Houston systems have COLAs that are related to their investment returns, where they do something similar to what you have in statute now, a five-year average, and then they subtract either the same 5% as you for police or 4.75% for fire. Fort Worth and Austin Police cannot offer any sort of COLA unless they go to the legislature and have specific legislation offered, so the city council can't do it, the board can't do it. It has to go to the legislature. And then obviously, ERF isn't public safety, but since it's you two, that one just is in effect and it's automatic. But it is simple in comparison to the San Antonio, which is compound. Oh, and I skipped Austin Fire, which I shouldn't, because that's one of our clients. Theirs is ad hoc, and it's based on the affordability, and right now they're in a position that the last 2 years they haven't been able to grant it.
And who is that one?
Austin Fire.
Austin Fire with affordability?
Yeah, so they have the affordability. It's basically, they have ad hoc COLAs. They can be issued by the board, but the board has a formal COLA policy that goes through and looks at what the changes would be for offering it. And the last 2 years, even though we've had high inflation, the board has only been able to approve a 0% COLA. And I know that phrase sounds weird, but they still have to approve it. So they approved a 0% COLA. And then just for comparison, PMRS and TCDRS, each individual city, county, entity adopts whatever COLA provisions they want or don't have. And they range from, you know, zero to a pretty full COLA.
All right, everyone, good. Like I said, you know, great job. I know personally, I know a lot more than I knew a couple hours ago, and you guys did a great job of sort of lining out the raw materials. And so thank you.
And appreciate it. Thank you. And yeah, let us know what feedback you have on specific options.
Okay, well, I gave you one, which is incorporate the different
right.
concepts.
Yeah.
So, one comment on the contribution recommendation. That you were clear to make that independent of any funding for the UAL, so that's just a cost that's going to be given to the city. Like,
yeah, the employee contribution?
Yes.
Yeah, that's...
that would be just the city component.
Yeah, it would just move between the employees and the city. So the same dollar amount would be coming into the system.
Thank you. Just one other thing on the employee contribution, because one of the points that Phil made very clearly is one of the things that should be one of the objectives in the pyramid for the board is having a plan that automatically adjusts and manages all of your circumstances. And in that employee contribution adjustment, you know, it will vary with what the actual experience is. So we're modeling our forecast, but it's dynamic.
Okay. I just have a quick question. So, the calculations of the ABC did not take into account any COLA program or?
So what the first part of our presentation, those ADCs did not have, it had the current COLA. We were showing the ADC with the different COLA provisions.
Okay.
So you can see how much it changed.
If we got the COLA, the liability would instantly go up, and then the ADC
right.
would be calculated off
right.
of that.
Yeah. So it definitely affects the ADC, and it affects both the normal cost and the payment towards the end.
As far as the COLA, right now you have it's based on fund percentage, which I deal with. Well, the potential issue with fund percentage is you hit your target and you fall back down below. You're going to cut it off once you start it. Also, the board has approval. The board adopts the assumptions and methods used in evaluations. I can recommend, I can't enforce any changes. So any like assumption changes, the experience studies, any kind of changes are made that impacts liability. So it's something to just keep in mind. You don't want to get to a point where you're asking boards debating on, well, we want to make this change because that's going to decrease our fund percentage and we can't do this. So, you know, I think ideally the COLA is not tied to the fund percentage, something wrong with that, but there's potential issues involved. There can be.
I can somewhat understand what you're saying. Yeah. Well noted. Bill, I appreciate you acknowledging that retention and recruitment can be tied to these factors. I also agree with that. Bill, going outside of the scope, I admit, but I appreciate you mentioning this.
Thank you.
Great. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. All.
Results, investment portfolio, and other important information. just going to show you some awards that we have earned. Here's the certificate from the GFOA, which is a certificate of achievement for excellence in financial reporting. And here on page 167, you'll also see we have received the Public Pension Standards Award for administration. As we move through the introduction section, there's an area that discusses the Board of Trustees and a couple of pages with your smiley faces on them. And we end the introduction section with our administrative organization and a list of our professional advisors. As we move to the financial section, what I want to mention here is the financial section mirrors 100% the audited financials. So everything that is in the audited financials that we publish as a separate report is in this financial section. So as we move through here, it starts with the BDO's report on the audit of the financial statement. And here on page 174, that second paragraph, you will see their opinion. In our opinion, the accompanying financial statements present fairly in all material respects. So that's a clean opinion. That's what we work for every year and have been able to accomplish. After the initial report, there's also a report on internal control, as Jill was sharing with you earlier. They do have to look at internal control as part of the audit. The next item is our management discussion and analysis. It is 7 pages in total. It provides some high-level summary of the activities of the plan during the past couple of years. If you look at nothing else, this is the place to start with management's discussion and analysis. Again, 7 pages, quick read, and it'll give you an overview of what's happening here. Within the management's discussion and analysis, you'll see the first combined statement of fiduciary net position. This presentation is a 3-year presentation, and the net position for 2022 was $1.8 billion. And that's a decrease of $353 million from the prior year, that's due primarily to investment losses and benefit payments exceeding contributions, something that we've been talking about this morning. On the next page, you'll see the combining statements of changes in fiduciary net position. City contributions increased by $5.1 million over the prior year, or 3%. Member contributions increased by $1.2 million, or 2%, and that increase was due to increased salaries. As we move down the page, we look at our net investment loss during 2022 was $245 million. That was driven by both public market changes and the changes in the fair value of our private equity assets. I want to move through here. Again, you'll see some charts, funding overview, until we come to page 186. These are the same financials that you saw earlier, but it is broken into the combined pension plan and the supplemental pension plan, and this is the only time during the year that you actually see separate financials for the two plans, because normally our presentation is a combination of those two plans. So you see 2022 and 2021, a little more detail than what you saw before, both the combining statements and the changes here on 186 and 187. The notes begin on page 188, and the notes provide important information about the financial statements and the overall status of the plan. Here on page 188, you'll see information about the membership. So the combined plan had total non-active members increased from 5,891 to 6,015. That's an increase of 124. and active members decreased from 5,088 to 5,085 in 2022. If we go to the next page and we'll take a quick look at supplemental, total non-active members increased by 3 and active members increased by 2. I specifically want to mention in the notes that are here, there's 12 notes, but I want to mention note 3. Note 3 is about investments. It begins on page 198 of the diligence presentation, and it provides detailed information and comparisons about the investment. So there's fair value tables, there is a fixed income maturity table, there's foreign currency tables. So again, you're seeing a lot of different information presented about investments in this section. Also included in the financial section is what is known as required supplementary information. Let me see if I can get there. So you'll see multiple years that presents 9 years of information, history of plan changes, its investment returns, it's detailed expense information, all that can be found in the required supplementary information here in the financial section. So again, multiple years, changes of benefit terms, changes in methods and assumptions, contributions, all of that in this last section here in the financial section. Then we move on to the investment section. So this section talks about the investment activities, investment performance, and investment initiatives during the year. One, it starts with a letter from Makita, giving them, with them providing information. And one of the tables that I like the best here is on page 243 and 244. This table includes the 1, 3, 5, and 10-year returns by asset category and class, and it's measured against the benchmark. And here on this table, about in the middle, let's see if I can kind of highlight it right there, it shows the overall time-weighted investment return for 2022 was a negative 2.2% on the portfolio. A couple of other interesting tables here, asset allocation, looking at it by broad asset category, by asset class, the asset evolution. I always think this is a great chart too, where we were to where we are, especially as you look at global equity, that's really tells the story. Here on page 249, there's information about investment fees. And again, about in the center here, you'll see the investment fees for 2022 were $9.7 million. Again, information that you find here that you don't normally see presented during the year. What were our largest public equity and fixed income holdings? For us in 2022, Alphabet and Microsoft. And you can see that even though they're our largest, they are well under 3% there. And then down at the bottom here, you'll see a listing of all of our investment managers. If you ever want to know, this is the place you can come look at that. As we move out of the investment section and we move into the actuarial section, first thing it starts with is a letter from Siegel, and all of this information was presented previously from the actuarial reports in December and in January, from both the combined and the supplemental reports. Provides information about funding, and again, our funding ratio for the combined plan, it declined to 39.1%. from 41.1% in the prior year, and that's primarily due to investment losses on an actuarial basis. You'll see information about actuarial assumptions and methods here. Again, some interesting information. Here on page 262, there's a turnover chart here, and it talks about the assumed rate of turnover for employees for both police and fire, and they are different. You know, if you look at the 10 years, police are at 3.5, fire is at 1%. So, again, interesting information there. Yes, information about benefit types. Here's the active member evaluation. How many active members over the last 10 years? Here's information about retirees and benefits added and removed from the role, funding progress. So a lot of good information in here related to the actuarial report. As we move to the last report, it's statistical information, and in this section, it just provides additional historical perspective, context, details, good trending reports. Most of them are 10 years or almost to their way to 10 years. You'll see a new term introduced in the section called consolidated plans. So we have the combined plan, we have the supplemental plan. When we present those results together, we call them the consolidated plan. And you'll see a lot of that here in the statistical section. So one of the first tables that you see here is changes in fiduciary net position. So you've seen the same information previously in the summary information in MD&A, and then you saw it broken out between the combined plan and the supplemental plan. Here it's broken out again, but this gives you a 10-year history. Okay, John, I'm not sure what I did there. Thank you. So you see there's your changes again, regular and supplemental. Distributions by type, both in chart and in table format. Then you have benefit recipients by type. So you could look at this table and, you know, if you're saying, well, how many of our members receive a benefit that's less than $500? There it is on the top line, 65. You have 65 beneficiaries or members that are receiving a benefit of less than $500. And how that is broken out between service retirement, disabilities, and the beneficiaries there. So interesting information. Yearly retirements by service years. If we were to look at the bottom line, 2022, you'll see there were 159 retirements there. What was their average, their final average salary, and what is their average benefit? So we have 10 years of information here from 2013 to 2022 where you can look at that, and also based on how many years did they serve. One more that I like, again, it's membership information. What was the membership according to several categories? Whether they're active or active drop, disabilities, retirees, you'll see that here in this information. So it's a quick walkthrough, but I hope I've intrigued you. I hope you're interested enough to pick up the book and read it and see what could be in here. Again, always consider this your go-to if you have a question about the system. Hopefully you'll find it here. The prior years beginning from 2014 forward are posted on the website. So if you were like, I want to see another year, you can go there and look. We do have hard copies of the report available for you. You can pick them up from Melissa here on your way out. If you do need a soft copy, let us know and we'll be happy to email a soft copy to you.
I would like to add that I'm not sure from the statute, but I think there's a 10-year statute of limitations on profile pictures.
I want to point out that I don't know if it was the filter or the lighting that someone suggested, but it's a younger, more handsome version of me, and I want to record I appreciate whoever did that.
So just be mindful of that. Brenda,
know, you play a primary role on illustrating this and a lot of the formatting. And I take this with me every in line how to go to that.
John Holt, who helps us dig through all the data and find all that statistical information.
February was very similar to January. We had 22 refunds. The other big number is retirement. It actually says 9. I need to add one to that that came in a little bit later, so it's basically equal to January. And the 6 new survivor payments and estate payment, one person joined drop it to keep it off service. Pretty standard month, and it's actually slower than last year. As far as the contribution report, this is the December 23 data. And in this report, it's always kind of nice to get the year-end report. On page 297 of Diligent, we have the year-end numbers. So in 2020, whatever year we just ended, 2023, we received $159 million from the city contributions. The four was 151. We knew the four doesn't really matter anymore. So that's where we are. They actually did make a little bit of headway in hiring, mostly in the fire department. They ended 2023 with on payroll 5,136 people, which is 200 more, 201 more than 2017 and 62 more than last year. So they're making a little bit of headway on the personnel. Any questions on the contribution report? Okay. Uh-oh, John. Well, he fixes that. The next item is the Board Education of Trustees policy. In the prior month, we've approved people to attend some of the tech first things. Tina, did you want to need to add these to these?
Yes,
please. Okay. I'll need a board action. Tina has expressed interest in attending the advanced trustee training as well as the annual conference. So a motion for that.
Motion.
Okay.
How much notice do you have to have to, if you just have to want to go to the advance? I mean, the registration one, you have to.
I don't know if it sells out, but we'll find out and let you know.
Which one? Do you know which one?
The advance.
Which one? The
number two.
I don't think they have space on the table.
I might be interested in advance, but I have my schedule.
Okay. We'll find out.
And that will probably be the general.
Yeah, we'll register for both. Okay, thank you. Did we have a second time?
Not yet. Okay. I'm sorry. All in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries.
The other thing I want to mention on that is CRB added 3 new classes on their website.
Oh,
continuing education, yes.
And the interesting
there is an after on the stand association. There's a
what?
Hey, whoever's on the line, we're getting a lot of noise.
So for example, in Custer that used to be here, many of you worked with him. He came here from Illinois, and he had lots of service at another, you know, state plant. But when he came here, had we been in EMRS at the time, we wouldn't have been. But he would have had to take the leap of faith of I'm going to like them, and they're going to like me for 5 years. Otherwise, all the employer contributions and my pension are just lost. And you're not going to get somebody to do that that's longer tenure in their career. So this resolution allows pretty much any other governmental experience that you don't have credit for somewhere else to count for.
Yeah,
that's
pretty
standard,
no? I mean, like, a lot of people, it's pretty standard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, can we get a motion?
Motion.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Okay, the next item is timely, actually. So we came to you during the budget process and talked to you about needing to do some refresh of the equipment in this room. And at the time, we didn't really know exactly what we needed, so we didn't end up putting it in the room. Since then, we've had a major controller fail. We've obviously had sound issues now. Those two screens don't work. This doesn't work. So we are we're having more and more failures. It's becoming a lot more difficult. So we are recommending that we amend the budget for $80,000 to do the refresh. John, do you want to explain more?
Yeah, the controller, but then it also gets into the voice lift system, which is, I think some of these microphones puts out here without feedback. That also interfaces directly into our phone system. So we want to go through a conversion like we're doing now. It should also help with background noise. So they've improved that technology. And then the whole video system has to be upgraded as well.
Do you have to go through a whole thing, like process, or do you have to keep one in mind, vendors in mind?
So I reached out to about four different vendors, including one that bought the company that did the original install, and talked to all them about it.
Okay. So have you selected one, or you're just...
Yes, we've selected one if the board approves it. How long will it take for them to do it?
I don't know. It could take a while, because, you know, there's still some supply chain issues.
So tell me this again. What's the process for selecting?
So we did an informal process where he reached out to four vendors, and some of them, the job wasn't right for him. One of them didn't bid. He got this bid. Mm-hmm.
Did we reach out to any of the MWBs?
I don't know, John, did you?
I didn't look for that.
We can look to see if there's others and get more quotes.
Okay. We need to be very consistent when we go out for bids to make sure that, I think we make sure that the net is as wide as possible as to see who can provide service.
Okay. We'll definitely do that.
Okay, so the motion is to authorize the budget not to pick the vendor right now.
Right.
So we can. Okay, we have the motion.
Motion
over to increase the budget by 8,000. Second.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Tom, IAC.
Okay, I'll be just saying we had a meeting January 23rd. Good turnout. Covered 9 items. I'll cover those quickly. First, portfolio update, estimated 2023 return, 9.8%. Second, liquidation of private market assets continues to be a top focus. There was some discussion on the Dallas Police and Fire and City of Dallas issues on funding solutions, more education and communication. Another point was safety reserve and rebalancing. We had an update by staff. The potential drag on returns from the safety reserve was lessened with yields around 4 to 5%. We also talked about, and staff did as well, material distributions from the private market legacy assets still needed before more allocations are made to the public equity and new private market commitments. Talked about the funding of new global growth equity manager, December 18, 2023. Also, staff mentioned the custodian search underway with assistance by Accounts Implementation Services Group. We also got an educational perspective from Makeda on mean reversion and, you know, suggesting that over time, prices or returns of assets tend to move towards the historical average or mean. Interesting, but it's more a statistical tendency than an ironclad rule, so something just to be aware of. Talked about investment initiatives, 2024 plan, which Makeda will be working on. Then we got into views on asset allocation changes, and one was review the safety reserve, no change, continue to monitor given the opportunity cost. Two, we talked about emerging markets, and had a good discussion here. Bottom line, given all the risk and concerns, we're better off staying at the 5% level. Also, we talked about the natural resource farmland allocation, and the objective there is really just working with staff, monitor as the manager's winding down. Another was duration, and does material increase in yields warrant an increase in investment grade fixed income, or should we consider adding duration? Bottom line is no. There was consensus pretty much on looking at other flavors of fixed income as we go forward, such as opportunistic credit or private credit. And then finally, given our funding net cash outflow situations, would like Makeda, when they come through with the return assumptions, to not just cover the 10-year rates of return, but also 20-year rates of return. And that is it. Ryan, any additional thoughts or comments?
You did good attendance. The first time I can remember we had perfect attendance at the IAC, so that was good. And Tom covered most of my stuff today, so we're good. Appreciate it. And I'll go into a bit more on that allocation timeline, what that looks like going forward in here. Since we're behind, I'm just going to kind of move through a few things. On the custodian search, we have an on-site with Callum and helping us out with the search. They're coming in Tuesday and Wednesday after President's Day, kind of do operational review, some education, and then we'll kind of map everything out from there. On the asset allocation timeline, we got some ideas on what mixes we want to come back and show to the IAC in March. Tom hit on those, but it's kind of what to do with credit. I kind of like the idea of splitting out fixed income into investment grade and credit, and you can kind of handle public, private, everything you want to do over there. We want to do some more consultants on liquidity, and if we are looking at maybe a slight increase in the prep market allocation, what does that look like in the stress scenario? Can we handle that? And then on the ag, I think we have long-term harvest, 5% to ag, 5% to real estate, 5% to private equity. Kind of doesn't make sense with the reductions we're already seeing in our ag portfolio to have the same level of allocation to ag we have to the other two private markets allocation, so maybe that comes down a little bit to create some room for opportunistic or private credit. We plan to bring some stuff back to the IAC in March to look at, which would be sometime Q2, we'd be talking to the board about it. We're still 50% overweight private markets, we're in no rush, so we are going to look at a few more iterations or get through some additional liquidity work that could push the schedule out a little bit. Any questions? We don't have a long-term allocation. We have two Asian infrastructure funds left. I mean, it could be a potential down the road, but I think part of it too is we haven't made any new private market investments in 2016, so let's kind of figure out the process and how it works with all more and what that looks like before we start throwing more stuff in there. Any other questions on asset allocation plans there? Okay, give a few of these. This is the Fed yield curve chart. Mark's expecting rate cuts sometime into the summer, a little bit more than the Fed, but the market's been wrong a lot on that in the last 2 years, so keep that in mind. This chart is looking at asset class returns across all major asset classes, kind of goes into the mean reversion topic with the key to the far left over here to bring this trick and zoom in. A large cap US, that's US, has outperformed 14-year period now. emerging in developed market, non-U.S. by a large margin. Do we expect that to continue or reverse at some point? We're investing globally, so we kind of leave it up to our global equity managers to allocate to different parts of the market. Performance summary, we had 1 month here, performance was basically flat, up 10 bits on a public portfolio in January. Public portfolio continues to perform well, that performance 60-40 across all time periods. We started the year with 1.94 and we're at 1.93 billion now at the end of January. I covered that earlier. On the state of reserve, one thing we've noted, when we're calculating that net outflow per month, we take the average of the last three contribution amounts in and then the last most recent benefit payment. With, I think it's the rate that's kicked in, the net outflow went down to about 500K per month. So that's helping out a little bit on how much we have in the state reserve and how many months that covers. So, we are good on net benefit outflows through July of 25 right now. Pretty much up to target there. Any questions on the portfolio?
Good to see good positive number for 2023.
Yeah. We're it's not final yet, but we're expecting this is on the quarter lag of 9.8% in 2023.
Above the hurdle rate. So what? Oh, sorry, we're not doing the ABC yet, but we're about to. So we're
going to that. Make it a little cheaper for them, and they kicked in 25.
Okay. Okay. Let's go ahead and knock out D two, so that we can then go into closed session and be tracking. So Kelly, executive director's report.
Your MC-first monitors are attached. Your link for your text is right there. We had two open record requests. They're both from, like, research organizations for the last four meetings. As far as staffing goes, we promoted two administrative clerk one positions to two positions, which I'm really happy about. We've finally been able to make a path for people, which is great. So Kate, who you may have seen or talked to, who answers the phone, was one of the people promoted, and Brooklyn, who is up here setting up, was also promoted. We hired one person to replace one of them. Right now, she's kind of doing double duty. You may see her on the phone. Her name is Star, so we're happy that she's here. Still looking for one more. So things are good.
Okay. All right, so we're going to go into closed session now. I'll always for his concurrence with that.
I'm not going to introduce the topic or anything before we go to the vote.
Oh, you mean for Clarion?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's give it a 30-second or a minute update before we do that.
If you think.
No.
10 seconds.
Okay.
Voting, Kevin, are you on the line?
Yeah, Kevin, I'm on. Sorry, Ryan, I'm on. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Yep.
All right, so Clarion took over this portfolio of investments in 2015. There's one remaining investment in their portfolio, which is Kelsey Cates Lamar, which is in the Cedars neighborhood, just south of downtown off Lamar, south of 30. We're going to be talking about this in the post-session proposed sale on the entire portfolio. So with that, we're going to close session.